Hi, folks. This is Jeff Sachs. We've started a little conversation here in the classroom before we began, so I turned on the recorder so the people that are going to join us by archives can listen in also. I apologize. There was some problem on the Web Yeshiva website earlier today, and that may be causing a bug, which is preventing some people from logging in. So if you're listening to this class by archive because you were unable to log in, I apologize for that. And of course, if you have any questions, please feel free to email me with your questions or comments that you would have asked as we were going along. But I'm talking here with Shalom Sher, who's joining us from, I'm sorry, you're in Chicago?
No, I'm in Southern Illinois. I live in Urbana, although I'm in my office today. In Charleston, Illinois.
Okay. And we've been having a conversation all week offline. Shalom is a research psychologist, and one of his fields of research is the psychology of prayer. And part of your interest in, I had asked the people in the class if you could just jot me a note, and at least certainly those of you that are new to Web Yeshiva, some of you, of course, I know quite well after all these years, what your background is in learning and what your interest in this particular class is. And Shalom mentioned that he's interested in the psychology of prayer, and he thought that Rabbi Soloveitchik's teachings would be, I guess, insightful to your work. And you shared with me some of your research. So just for the benefit of everyone else, because I think they'll find it interesting, why don't you describe a little bit your work and your research and what you're hoping to see and understand, and how Jewish prayer is maybe like all prayer, and how it's different than all other prayers of other traditions.
The one aspect of my research is to look at the relationship between prayer, the types of things people do while praying, just generally, not just Jews, but everybody, and well-being. So,
well-being.
Sort of kind of mental health, physical health, things like that. And there's been a lot of research over the years claiming that prayer, people who pray more are healthier and happier, they get over sickness more easily. So people who are, who are recovering from illness, who pray, will get better faster. So we were looking at more kind of, is that true of all the things people do when they pray? Because we do, as we're seeing in this year, there's petition, but there's also praise and thanksgiving and other things that people do when we pray. What we found, and what other people have tended to find, at least in terms of how kind of their mental well-being, is that it's really praise or adoration and thanksgiving and maybe something else called reception. We call reception where it's sort of a more passive waiting for kind of wisdom from God or something like that. Those are the forms of prayer that seem to be connected to these positive outcomes. Other kinds of prayer, petition, confession, these don't seem to have that same connection. So I'm trying to look at why those differences, what's the causes of those differences, and whether it really is the fact that people who pray more are better off, or whether it could be the other way around, that it's just that people are better off and pray more. So we don't really even know the answer to that question. Uh-huh. Of course, that's really been looking at non-Jewish prayer, not exclusively, but mostly. Most of this research is done in the U.S., and it's done with general just groups of people, and of course, we're a small portion of that population, if there at all, and you take the people, the Jews who really pray regularly, that's even a smaller portion. But I've also started to look specifically at Jewish prayer, and I mean, Jewish prayer does contain, as we look at, seeing most of these same kinds of aspects, but it's very different because it's typically more of this ritualized prayer where you read a text, the obligatory three services a day, four, and so on. And so that's a very different kind of thing. I don't think people have looked at that very much or very well. So that's another interest of mine, kind of see how do people respond to that and psychologically while we're dominating, how can we, what's the sort of psychological
What's your hunch about what your research is going to turn up about Jewish prayer?
Well, I think, you know, we tried to do a study where we asked people kind of which parts of the davening do you kind of respond to and are you most focused on, and we tried to connect that to the things that we had found with non-Jewish prayer, that the people that were had the greatest sort of kavana for you know, the thankfulness aspects of prayer would have the benefits, like people who say they pray more, you know, kind of the more thankful kinds of prayers. I think a big part of that is because it didn't work that way. So some of my other research on when we started interviewing people don't have, you know, a kind of, you know, part of the davening. Well, I always feel really moved by this part. I'm always really concentrating on the meaning of this part of the davening.
Right.
I think what I really need to do, if it's, you know, possible someday, is to go to a minyan and stand outside afterwards and ask people as they come out, okay, today, what was the most meaningful, most focused part for you? and then ask them other questions about how they're feeling about other things. I don't know if that's going to ever be possible to do. I think the other thing that, you know, Rosax and I were talking about in our email interchanges over the week is the notion that, you know, davening in the Jewish context often gives you the sense of belonging, the sense of connectedness, especially if you daven with a minyan. Of course, you've got the support of the other people in your minyan and everything like that. One of the things that came out in my interviews with some people about this was that people also feel connected, not just to the people they're davening with physically in that exact same room and in that exact same minyan, but to other Jews around the world. We're all davening the same service, the same prayers, at, you know, at more or less the same time. And also, I think that can also reflect, you know, connections in history. I'm davening the same Shemot Esrei that my father davened, that his father davened, that his grandfather davened, going back. So, and, you know, I connect, you know, to all those kind of connections. It also gives a sense of belonging, and that's led me to some really interesting thinking about what to do in those situations.
Right. So I think one of the things that I pointed out was, and it's like I grew up in a shul in suburban New Jersey that was populated by, you know, I was a young boy, a teenager, but, you know, the daily minyan was made up of, you know, people who were, you know, quite a bit older than me. You know, at the time they all seemed like old men. Maybe they were, you know, in their, maybe they were just in their 60s, which now seems less old to me than it did when I was a teenager. But they were old men, certainly 60s and upwards, 60s, 70s, 80s, etc. And without the fact that a very good many of them were there because they were happened to be reciting Kaddish at any given point, you know, for whichever relative it was that they were reciting Kaddish, it's hard to imagine the minyan, you know, would have been a going concern in a regular way without this. You know, there were maybe, you know, a dozen and a half people that made up this daily minyan, which met at some ungodly early hour on weekdays because some people had to go off to work or to whatever it was, and without you know, this impetus of Kaddish sayers, the minyan wouldn't have taken place. And every morning after davening, there was this, you know, bottle of, I remember it was wild turkey, which I think is bourbon. I don't even think it's scotch. And it was like the miracle of Hanukkah. You know, every morning they'd all have a shot, and the next morning somehow the bottle would miraculously be refilled. Like I always imagine there was a drum in the back, and they would, like, the janitor would refill the bottle or something. And you know, these people were not, by and large, religious philosophers. And if you would have asked them about Rabbi Soloveitchik's teaching about the existential component of prayer, they wouldn't have known what you're talking about. And if you interviewed them on the way out about the meaningfulness of their prayer that day, they also would not have necessarily, or many of them would not know necessarily, but davening and being a member of that club was something that was very important and lent great meaning to their lives. So these are benefits that are associated with prayer, even though prayer is just kind of the, you know, the hook that brings them together, which produces the benefits. That was, I think, my question to you. My other point, which I guess is related to this, is we're looking at the writings of a particular religious thinker, you know, who thought and wrote and dealt with these issues at a particular time in 20th century American philosophy. I hope, I mean, as it should be apparent to all of you after spending all these weeks with me, these are ideas that have great resonance for me. I assume that for many of you it has great resonance for you, but it's one man's prayer. And there are certainly other traditions and other philosophical traditions and other thinkers and other bodies of thought on Jewish prayer that, you know, that would put forth other ideas. Maybe in the future we'll have an opportunity to learn them. So the question of, like, well, if we look at one particular angle on what Jewish prayer is and how that would then correlate with, you know, this research that you're doing about prayer and well-being and state of mind and things like that. So somebody might read this, and, you know, if you read it and you deal with the ideas and take it seriously, you might think, well, wow, you know, there's nothing here that's going to lend itself to peace of mind, quite the contrary. I think one of the sources that I mentioned earlier, much earlier in our series, is Rabbi Soloveitchik's famous long fourth footnote to his work, Halachic Man, which I can probably upload again for you, but in that long footnote, which is almost a kind of standalone essay, he takes on this idea that religion is meant to give you well-being and a healthy state of mind and make you happy and make you feel good and solve your problems. And, you know, he says, I'm pretty sure this is my formulation, but it's an accurate formulation of his idea. This idea that religion, you know, solves all your problems, gives you all the answers, which was a kind of mid 20th century American, largely Protestant American notion of what religion was. Remember the idea of the family that prays together, stays together, etc. So Rabbi Soloveitchik says something along the lines of, religion doesn't give you the answers to all your problems. It gives you the questions that keep you up at night searching for answers. That's not liable to be a philosophy of religion or philosophy of prayer that that the psychologists would be able to easily point to. But that being said, Shalom, not to discourage you from your work, that's not necessarily how most people that actually get up every morning and go to shul, that's not necessarily how they relate to prayer. So you still have work to do, despite the fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik's angle on it, you know, would point in an opposite direction. The value of dealing with the thought of any particular religious thinker lies in the strength of those ideas to resonate with the person that analyzes them. Whether or not it's something that's over la socher, whether or not it's something that really energizes the man on the streets or the man in the shul or the person that gets up at 5:30 in the morning to be the 10th guy that goes to Minyan. Who might be motivated by an array of different ideas, philosophical, sociological, spiritual, intellectual, whatnot. The fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik's ideas don't play into the organization of his religion, of this hypothetical character that I'm painting, his religious life, is all well and good. So, I'm sorry, I cut you off a second ago. You wanted to say something.
I don't remember exactly what to say, and I don't want to take up the whole sheer of talking about this instead of getting back to Rabbi Soloveitchik. I just was putting a link to a brief summary of the work of a psychologist named Daniel Bassett, who's also actually trained at a Methodist, I think, theological seminary as a minister. But he has proposed a notion of a type of religiosity called quest. If you go to the link, it talks about, and he says, quests. This is just a summary that someone wrote, I don't know who it is, but...
like religious quests.
Yeah, well, quest components include a readiness to face existential questions without reducing their complexity, perception of religious doubts as positive, and an openness to future change in one's religious views.
Okay.
So it sort of has this sort of idea that a very positive form of religiosity is this kind of quest and these existential questions and all. And I want to stress that just before I, you know, I'm going to shut up and people are not getting bored of hearing me talk, but that my interest in the class is not only because of my professional interests. In I'm very interested in learning, you know, kind of what Rabbi Soloveitchik has to say about prayers for my own part of the you know of my interest. I don't know what I was going to say. But and I think that prayer is important for reasons beyond, and religion is important for reasons beyond going beyond well-being and everything, but it does have that effect. So I don't think that that's, you know, I'm not sure those are sort
of true. Okay. Well, we'll wait for the results of your study. As I get started here now in the shiur proper, just take a look in the chat. Sherry posed the questions. You show them. You can respond to
them. I'm writing an answer now.
Okay. I'm linking in the chat something that I sent out earlier in the week, which is a link to an essay by Rabbi Sholem Carmi, who happens to be the editor of the volume wherein the essay that we've been looking at resides, the volume of Worship of the Heart, Rabbi Soloveitchik's Essays on Jewish Prayer. And this essay that we've been looking at these last few weeks, Reflections on the Amidah, Rayonot al Tefillah. So a number of years ago, 20, 25 years ago, Rabbi Carmi wrote this essay in the journal Tradition. The essay is called Destiny, Freedom, and the Logic of Petition. And there he analyzes in greater length this question that we've been talking about last week and even the week before, about the centrality of petition, of petitionary prayer, of asking God for things instead of a kind of model of prayer which is meditative or thanking God or things like that, but prayer which at its heart, and you know the bulk of our prayer, 70% of the words of the Amidah are the list of the 13 bakashot, the categories of requests that we make, and why that's central to Jewish prayer. So you can take a look at that essay. I'm not sure what our schedule is, how many weeks we have left. I am planning that we should have Shi'ur next week, even though it's Shivasar B'Tammuz. I mean, over here in Israel, it'll be after the evening following Shivasar B'Tammuz, the fast day. And for those of you that points to the west of me, it will either be at some point in the day during the fast day. But I'm hoping that we can still meet. And if there's time, we have another one or two shiurim to finish up this essay we've been doing. Then maybe I'd like to turn my attention to Rabbi Carmi's essay. And then that's, of course, the end of this particular series, at least for now. Here we are. Let me just take a look at who's on the line. If you have a webcam, please turn it on. And again, I apologize for the for any trouble people had logging on, or if you're listening to this archives because you weren't able to log on live. Our apologies for the tech problems that crashed the website earlier. But it seems to me that many of the regulars are here with us online. And those of you logging in late, we've been having a very interesting conversation with Sholem Sher, joining us from Illinois, talking about his research on psychology and prayer. The need for praise and thanksgiving. The need for praise and thanksgiving. Thanksgiving meaning thanking God, not the holiday with a turkey. It's impossible to recite the middle benedictions without the first three. Now, he reminds us of this idea that we know from our experience, and which he's mentioned before, that the Amidah is made up of three sections, three blessings at the end, three blessings at the beginning, and 13 blessings in the middle for a total of 19 blessings. The first three are praise of God. The final three are thanking God, although he's going to ask a second, yeah, is that really true? Because if you look at the concluding three blessings, they don't all look like thanks. As a matter of fact, it looks like there's a bunch more requests that we've thrown in. He's going to address that. And then, of course, the middle 13, which are the list of bakashot, of requests. This is impossible. It's impossible to to ask God for things without first prefacing it with the praise of God. And now he, by way of example, he makes a point. He quotes the Gemara. The Gemara in Brachot Das, on Palad Omer Aleph, 34a. I had intended on reading it on the inside, but since we were a little delayed in starting, I'm just going to summarize it for you. But here you have the Gemara if you want to see the original. The Gemara mentions the idea, after the Gemara's discussion of the Amidah, of the standard set prayer, it mentions various types of shortened prayers or supplemental prayers or substitute prayers or prayers that are said when the regular Amidah is not possible. So he who goes in a place of wild animals or robbers recites an abridged prayer, a tefillah ketzara be'et sakana, an abridged prayer, a reader's digest of the Amidah. If you're unable to stop and recite the regular Amidah, so you can recite this abridged prayer. And it seems that the Gemara seems to think it's not that you can't stop because you're busy. It's not that you can't stop because you're trying to catch a train. It's you can't stop because there's a bear chasing you or there's a bandit chasing you. In the Rinat Yisrael Siddur, I mean, this is not a very operative prayer, meaning probably none of us have ever actually used this or had to rely on this abridged prayer, although it does appear in various sidurim. But in the Rinat Yisrael Siddur, which is a kind of popular siddur here in Israel, less so in America, in the Rinat Yisrael Siddur, which has probably been around for, I don't know, 35, 40 years here in Israel, the prayer appears. And the instructions don't talk about being chased by bears or bandits, which are fewer and far between today than they once were, but by maybe a soldier who is standing guard. He's on guard duty. And it could be that you're on guard duty at the time of davening. And while you're on guard duty, you can't take a break. You're forbidden from turning your attention away. You wouldn't be able to stop and say the Amidah, again, depending upon the Tanai Shetach, as we say here in Israel, on the condition on the ground. But let's imagine it's you're guarding in a very tense time or a tense circumstance, or you're literally at the front at a time of battle or a time of war, and it's not possible to daven the Amidah. But you might be able to have enough flexibility to daven this shortened prayer. So that's an actual contemporary application of this prayer that the Gemara imagines you're saying while running away from wild animals. So what is it? What is the text of that prayer? So the Gemara mentions a few different articulations, a few different versions of what this prayer is. Rabbi Eliezer says, Aseret soncha mima'al, do your will in heaven above and give satisfaction to those who fear you below and do what is good in your eyes. Baruch atah Hashem, shomea tefila. Blessed are you, God, who listens to prayer. All of these short prayers end with Baruch atah Hashem, shomea tefila. Like, by the way, tefilat haderech, the prayer that a traveler says, which is something that most of us have participated in, experienced in the short prayer that said when you're on a particular type of journey, that prayer ends with the kind of catch-all request, Baruch atah Hashem, shomea tefila. The idea that God listens to prayer is itself the epitome of prayer. Rabbi Yehoshua has a different version of this short prayer for a dangerous time. The cry of your people Israel, quickly do their petition. Others said, a third version, the needs of your people are many and their intelligence is limited. Sorche amcho mirubin, the da'atan kitzera. May it be your will to give each according to his needs and his deficiency. This is, I'm sorry, I put up 34, no, I'm sorry, it's 29b. I put up the wrong Gemara. I can get the right one for you momentarily. Here you go. I just clicked on the wrong piece when I was uploading it. Here it is, but it's of course upside down, so let's fix that. 29B. So the Rav says, this brisa deals with the strange problem. According to the halakha, the abridged prayer does not fulfill a person's obligation to pray. This abridged prayer is not, it's not like a Reader's Digest to the Amida. The Gemara here also, in the same context, does talk about a Reader's Digest version of the Amida. That's a tefillah called Havinenu, which is literally a summary of the 13 blessings. You would recite, again, it's not so practical, even though it does appear in certain sidurim. It can't be recited all the time. It can't be recited when certain seasonal additions have to be added to the Amida. But the Havinenu prayer is, instead of having to recite all 13 bakashot, requests in the middle, you would daven the first three blessings, the last three blessings, and in the middle, you have one blessing that summarizes the themes in a stitch, in a phrase. It summarizes all 13 blessings condensed into one blessing. That's not what this prayer is. This prayer, the Tefillah Ketzara Be'et Sakana, the prayer at a dangerous time, is not in place of the Amida. As a matter of fact, the Gemara asks, what's the difference between this abridged prayer and that abridged prayer, between the prayer said at a dangerous time and the summarized prayer? The summarized prayer might be the case of the guy who has to run to catch the train and doesn't have time to daven the whole prayer. Or it might be recited by someone who doesn't know the whole prayer. Remember, at a time before Sidurim, before printed texts or manuscripts, which of course were expensive and rare, here I am in my study. So you see all those books? I mean, that's just one shelf of books. So there's a whole shelf there with, I don't know, there's probably 50 Sidurim there. Why we have so many Sidurim, I don't know. But now everybody has Sidurim. You have Sidurim in your car, you have Sidurim in your tefillin bag, you carry a sitter with you in your briefcase, you have a sitter in your desk drawer at work. I mean, we have Sidurim all over. We live in an era of, and everybody of course has them on their phone and on their iPod and on their iPad, and there's no shortage. But that was not always the case. So to pray really meant you needed to have committed it to memory, which was not possible for everyone. But maybe someone could have, remembering all 13 blessings, they could have memorized this one summary blessing. So maybe that's what the Havinenu is for. Do I ever use all of them? No, I probably, some of them have probably never been opened. They just, you know, Sidurim that collect. You go to a bar mitzvah, you get a sitter, you, whatever it is. So the Gemara asks, what's the difference between the dangerous time summary prayer and the Havinenu, the kind of Reader's Digest compendium prayer? The Gemara says the Reader's Digest commending prayer, that really is prayer. And if you pray it, you have fulfilled your obligation. If you pray the Havinenu, the abridged prayer, and then later somebody says, oh, here's a sitter. You can daven the whole thing now. Well, having had already daven the Havinenu, you don't need to daven again. That's not true for the Tefillah Ketzara Be'et Sakana, the Tefillah that has these three different traditions or three different versions of what the prayer itself is. That is not in place of the Amida. And if while running away from your bear you recite it and then the bear leaves you alone and you still have plenty of time left before the sun sets, let's say, So then you still have to recite the conventional Shemona Esrei. So Rabbi Soloveitchik asks, why is it that this Tefillah Kitzarah is not a substitute for the Amidah when you're in a pinch? So according to Halacha, the abridged prayer does not fulfill a person's obligation to pray. Legally, it does not come under the category of prayer at all. In that case, meaning, what does he mean when he says it doesn't? By now, you should all know the answer to this question. But Rabbi Soloveitchik says that this shortened prayer in a dangerous circumstance is not in the category, halachically, legally, when he says legally, he means halachically, it does not come under the category of prayer at all. What does he mean by that? Nope. Ah, yafeh. It means that it's not an amida. It's not a tefillah with a capital T. And again, I remind you what I've told you again and again and again. In halachic literature, prayer means the amida, not in the conventional sense that we mean. When we say conventionally prayer, we're talking about all of the prayers from page one until the end. But in halachic literature, and technically speaking, prayer, tefillah, means the Amida. So when you recite the shortened prayer in a dangerous circumstance, you, without sandwiching it between Shevach and Hoda'ah, big praise and thanksgiving, it's not a prayer. By definition, it's not a prayer. In that case, why did the rabbis attribute significance to the exact formula of this benediction? So if that's the case, if it's not technically an Amidah, but it doesn't fulfill your obligation of thrice daily prayer, so what do you need to have a formula for? Like, why have a set text? Why not just say, you know, when you're running away from a bear, when you're running away from a robber, should you have the wherewithal to pray to God, so good luck to you. You should do it. Yeah, I mean, you know, the idea that there are no atheists in foxholes or that kind of silly, pithy expression about prayer in public schools, that as long as there are tests, there will always be prayer in public school. I don't know about that, but it might be true that people, like, you know, when you feel that you're in a dangerous circumstance, people tend to pray. So then, but why do you need to set a text for that prayer? Let each person devise his own formula. So Rabbi Soloveitchik says, this braisa, the quote from the Gemara that we just read, articulates the idea we just expressed. If the praying individual is unable to present before God the entire order of prayer in its authentic form, to arrange God's praise and beg leave to approach him boldly, to mention the merits of the patriarchs and God's graciously attending to the visions of every creature, then he is not permitted to petition for his needs. You can't just ask God for something. Even though we believe that our prayers are, the set prayers are a floor and not a ceiling, it's the base and not the limit, that people are always allowed to pray, that's that lovely passage from Rav Kook that we learned a while back about the praying soul, that we're always praying, we're constantly praying. We constantly should be in communion with God, regardless of the set ritual obligation to recite the Amidah. But nevertheless, Rabbi Soloveitchik says you can't just throw your requests up to God. You can't just say, you know, oi, I've got trouble. It has to be done within that context of praise and thanks. That's the formula, the matbeya of tefillah. A few weeks ago, we made reference to our old friend Tevye, also in that context of somebody that was always in this kind of dialogue with God, dialogue with God, arguments with God, kvetching at God, like saying to God, was it nice that you made my horse lame? Was it nice that, I have a wife who's, who's a nag, et cetera, et cetera. So that idea, that kind of very perfect example, by the way, of the caveat that I made at the beginning, that Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy of prayer is all well and good, but it may have nothing to do with the way an average Jew living in Anatevka or in the shtetl or in the big city or, whether it's the 19th century or the 21st century, actually lives his life and engages in a life of prayer. That's a different question. So if, without mentioning the merits of the patriarchs and God's graciously attending to the divinities of every creature, he is not permitted to petition for his needs. Egoistic supplication outside the framework of the prayer formula instituted by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola is forbidden. For this reason, Rabbi Elazar prohibited any request. He allows himself only an eschatological prayer. Right? Rabbi Eliezer's prayer, you're running away from a bear. So if I told you, write me a prayer to be said for like escaping the bear, escaping a lion, escaping a bandit, so what would you write? Well, it might have something to do with, sharp teeth or sharp knives and being rescued therefrom. But what's Rabbi Eliezer's prayer in this dangerous circumstance? Do your will in heaven above, do what is good in your eyes. An eschatological prayer. Right? We're telling God, you it's a recognition, it's not even a request almost, even though it's kind of phrased to sound like a request. It's a recognition that God runs the world. It's a statement of hashkacha, of providence. God, you must have a plan. Hard for me to see it right now as I'm running away from the wild animals, but you must have a plan. Do your will. Rabbi Eliezer prohibits even entreaty for the community. Rabbi Yoshua holds to the rabbis. He's now analyzing each of the three different versions of what the prayer is. Rabbi Yoshua holds that the rabbis were somewhat more lenient and allowed supplication to God for the nation in general, but not the individual. Remember, what was Rabbi Eliezer's, what was Rabbi Yehoshua's version? Rabbi Yehoshua said, the cry of your people Israel, quickly do their petition. What do you mean the people Israel? I'm the only person that's being chased by this wild animal. So, you can't pray for yourself. You have a very serious need. It's called the lion's gaping maw. In the cartoon, he would have already bitten the seat of your pants. But you can't pray for yourself just kind of out of the blue. So it has to be kind of formulated as a kind of national prayer about the Tzorchei Amcha Yisrael, the needs of the Jewish people. And within all the needs of the Jewish people, this one needs parnasa, and that one needs some food, and this one needs a refuah shalema, and this community is down on its luck, and that synagogue burned down, and these people are having a pogrom, and me, I'm being chased by a wild bear. So you can only make that kind of ad hoc petition in the context of the larger needs of the community, but as an individual, you're not allowed to doing it. It's not just her. Sherry, what do you mean by that? Oh, Taka. Oh, in other words, maybe it's a, I don't know if it's a specific reference to I don't know if it's a specific reference to the beginning of Sefer Shmot. About the tzaka, but it's probably a militsa. It's probably playing off of those words. others, the third opinion that's brought anonymously in the BRISA, others devised a specific formula which attested to man's poverty of mind and expresses confidence in God's graciousness, following which it would be permissible to push for fulfillment of the needs of individuals, but not to detail them. The third opinion, which is even more lenient in terms of allowing you to make this kind of ad hoc emergency petition, even that has limitations. But certainly the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer is that you can't make any individual petition unless it is formulated within the context of the rigid structure of an Amidah. And because you cannot ask for your own needs until you have made the praise of God, but part of the praise of God is the relationship with my forefathers, because that's what gets my foot in the door, that I, as a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I, as a member of the collective unit of the Jewish people, that's what gives me the right to make a petition. And that's why Jewish prayer has to be bookended at the beginning with the Shevach, with the praise of God. So interestingly, it brings us to an answer to that age-old question. What does God need our praises for? Is God an egotistical God that needs our praises, that needs us to extol him? No. The extolation that we make of him is a declaration of the historical record. And that historical record, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, God's involvement in the universe, God's concern with individuals, God's ruling of the world with a system of reward and punishment, so that I'm both accountable, but I then also have the opportunity to petition him, because we live in a world where I'm entitled to be answered. My prayers are entitled to be answered. The entirety of the praise of God is not for the purpose of praising God per se. It's to set up the opening of the door, again, not because we're trying to grease his palm, pardon the expression, to grease the wheels, to grease the hinges of the door so that we can open the door. But the praise itself is the historical record by which I have a right to pray, by which I have a right to petition. And that's why petition comes first. It's what Rabbi Soloveitchik, in a kind of halachic context, had declared is a matir. How in the world, how dare we throw our petty concerns at the feet of God? Who are we that he should listen to our concerns? Ah, we are the children of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. We are part of the created universe in which he has taken an interest. And therefore, I'm going to tell him what interests me. That's why petition is the opening, that's why praise is the opening salvo of Jewish prayer. Let's forge on a little bit ahead. Let me look at Peter's comments. Prayer is a petition to be able to see, quote unquote, his God's wisdom, not as a wish that he change. Not sure what you mean by that he see his own wisdom. It's not that he changed. We're not asking God to change. We're asking him we're demonstrating that we are mindful of our own needs. And that mindfulness of our own needs may or may not cause some kind of change in where we are, in what's happening to us. But it's not that we can, force his hand. But what do you mean, Peter, by what do you mean that to petition to see his wisdom? I mean, maybe that's like a kind of way of saying all change is in us, not in him. I don't know if all change is in us. Not all. No, and I don't know that all is good. Suffering is bad, and people actually suffer. And prayer does not always alleviate that suffering. Either the prayers that we make to alleviate our own suffering or the prayers that we make to alleviate other people's sufferings. But that's kind of irrelevant because that is not the reason we pray, Rabbi Soloveitchik would say. We pray because we have an obligation to pray. In a sharper formulation of Yeshaya Leibovitz, the well-known Israeli thinker, philosopher, who was an almost exact contemporary, that his dates are almost exactly contemporaneous to Rabbi Soloveitchik's, Yeshaya Leibovitz. If you're not familiar with him, you can Google him and find some things online about his rather idiosyncratic religious philosophy. But Leibovitz, you know, famously said the idea that there's only one reason you pray. You pray because you are commanded. It's a mitzvah like all other mitzvot, and this is an idea that Rabbi Soloveitchik explored, we saw a few weeks ago. And that any other idea that prayer is going to accomplish something or do something or change God's mind or fix our situation, whatnot, is not only mistaken, but it's idolatrous. Because instead, therefore, of worshiping God, we end up worshiping ourselves. That notion, I'm going to pray and everything is going to change for me, is a kind of idolatry, maybe with a lowercase I, not actual idol worship, but it's worship of the self. That prayer is not about accomplishing those kinds of getting a response to our needs, but that the halacha felt there was a need for us to articulate our own needs, and then maybe we'll do something on our own, but not that it changes God, not that it influences God. Now this is contra to other strains in Jewish thought, particularly the Hasidic model, which saw prayer as a very vibrant outpouring of one's soul that really would have the potential to impact on heaven. And to wit, you can find, you know, countless Hasidic tales where this exactly happens. So it's not exactly clear. You know what, I think I am going to pause here, and hopefully we will conclude the essay next week, and then we'll have a kind of wrap session the week after. But there's just very little left here. So if you haven't, you know, reading the whole thing, this is your last chance to do so. Again, apologies to those of you that have trouble logging in. Hopefully we'll get those problems straightened out. We will continue next week. Again, next week, Shivasar B'Tammuz, wherever you are. It will either be during the fast or after the fast, and hopefully you'll be able to join us.